Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are. It is another week, and it's another sit down. As always, Wednesdays is sit down day. As I said, I hope you're having a great week. We're getting closer and closer to fall. Feels like these seasons go so quick anymore. Feels like we were just at Memorial Day. Now we're already towards Labor Day, about 2 weeks away from Labor Day. Football will be starting. Start to get that smell outside. Fireplaces burning, leaves rustling. Halloween will be here. And then Christmas and all that other stuff. The wheels keep on turning here, as they say. As always, make sure you give us a follow on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Make sure you check us out on YouTube as well. We do some really good crime and mob content over there as well. All you have to do is search the Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. So obviously, if you guys follow us on Twitter, I tweeted out, I believe it was on Monday, that it was important that everybody listen to the show this week. If you're a fan of this content, I had something that I wanted to say and I wanted to kind of clear up. As we head into really busy time of the year for me. You know, when I started this show back in April 2021, I never exactly thought it would become what it's become. And what it's become is a show that people like to consume. They like learning about really every level of the American mafia. You know, we've done so many episodes. We've done over 70 episodes on this show. But I have to admit, guys, I never thought it would get to where it has been. You know, every day I get people tell me, hey, I love the show. I'm glad you're doing it. I've learned so much. I like this. I like that. It's appointment listening for me. It's great having these on long road trips, all that sort of thing. But the truth is, guys, and I keep saying the truth is, I've never taken any time off of this show. Since I started it in April of 2021, I've been here pretty much every week. You know, when I had things going on, I would always make sure we would record an episode and have it pumped out. You know, we've been doing this over a year strong. You know, there's 52 weeks in a year. You know, we've done about 72, 73 episodes, I believe. So, you know, basically we've done this for 73 straight weeks. And it's taxing. This is a show that when I started, I wanted to make sure we right the wrongs of a lot of things, you know, trying to clear up things, making sure we do the research that's essential for making this content the best of the best. I know when we started it, I knew that we weren't always going to be able to tell a new story. There's only so much you can tell about, you know, John Gotti or Vincent Gigante or Al Capone, but I truly wanted to bring you the smaller gangsters, the interesting guys, the earners, the killers. The guys that you know, maybe you didn't know a ton about, and that takes a lot of research. It takes a long time to make these shows what they are. And you know, right now, guys, as I embark on another football season, a football season that is going to culminate into basketball, it's just so busy for me. And I've really taken and decided that we're going to take some extended time off from the show. You know, it's really for me a time to really kind of think, reflect on what I've done. And, you know, maybe at some point we'll take this in another direction. But for me, I need a little bit of a break from this. I have so many things that I'm doing. You know, in the summer, it's easy because I don't have as much going on. But, you know, I'm taking on a lot of responsibility. I also have some stuff going on in my personal life that I have to attend to. And for me, I just need to take some time away. I need to recalibrate. I need to refigure out where this genre is going to take me. And the truth is, I also will say this. This is a genre that, you know, for me has really become monotonous. You know, I've talked about so much mafia stuff that, you know, it's become almost melded together in a way. And I think for me, if I do continue this at some point, it is going to be something that's a little bit more embarked on as far as, you know, I thought last week's show, you know, taking it in a direction of, you know, just more than just mobsters. You know, the true crime genre is so big, you know, and it's almost like a mafia family, right? There's factions, right? There's the Brooklyn crew, the Bronx crew, the Staten Island crew, the New Jersey crew. There's so many different subsets of true crime. You know, you have serial killers, you have organized crime, you have gangs, you have drug dealers, you have war crimes, you have gore, you have infamous murderer. You have all sorts of stuff. And it's just, for me, something that I think the time has come for us to take some time away. And it's not forever. You know, it's not going to be something that I stop and we never come back to. If we come back to this, you know, kind of when I recalibrate in a month or two or whenever it is, you know, maybe we'll expand on it. You know, we'll return. You know, I probably still will do some YouTube content. I mean, maybe one video a week. You know, on the YouTube channel, it's a little easier to put out content because when I do a show on this program, you know, I want to make it, you know, in depth. You know, I mean, I remember when I did that Carlos Marcello show. I mean, there was it took so long because there was so much that went into it. You know, when I interview someone, you know, I want to make sure a lot of the time it's something one you haven't heard of or you haven't heard much from. So what we're going to kind of do is we're going to do the show as normal today. Next week, we're going to do a show as well. And next week's going to be our final episode for a while. And it's going to kind of end season one of the show, if you will. And we'll come back maybe with season two at some point. And, you know, we just want to recalibrate. I just kind of figure where I'm going to go with all this. Because, again, like, I never believed that this show would become what it's become. And it's been very integral to my life. It's something that, you know, I felt is truly special because, you know, sports has always come easy for me. That's always been kind of my thing. But I truly was able to get into a genre that I had a passion for, that I was interested in. And I'll never stop being interested in this stuff. You know, I'll still maintain, like I said, maybe some sort of YouTube channel and, you know, I'll try to keep it fresh. But this is a dying genre. It's just that simple. You know, you don't have the news anymore. You know, you can only talk so much about the guys. And we've done so many different shows. And I know there's guys maybe we haven't gotten to, and that will allow us down the road to revisit this at some point. But it's important that at some point we revisit it, we expand it, and we make it into more of an ever-arcing true crime genre channel. So that's kind of my message tonight. You know, I hope people understand. You know, it's something that I've always tried to bring quality and put time into it. And it's just, I need a break from it. You know, I need to focus more on my other stuff, you know, my other stuff that I'm doing. As I said, some of my personal things that I have going on. And it's hard, man, when you know, you want to go to the shore and you have to sit here and spend 2-3 hours doing a show. You have to make sure it gets recorded, gets edited. You know, you got to make sure all that's done. And it's a big overtaking. So, you know, that's kind of my rant, guys. I hope you guys all understand. And it's not forever. It's just going to be for now. You know, we still have the feed. You know, we're always going to have these episodes. You can always revisit them and listen to them again or check out something you've missed. It's not like the show is going to completely go away. As I said, you know, I'd urge you to go check out our YouTube channel. I'm going to really kind of, you know, try to do some videos on there a little bit. And as I said, it's a little easier on YouTube just because, you know, I don't have to put as much time into it. It's really only once a week. And I'm even cutting that down. I've been doing 2-3 videos a week on YouTube. So I'm just trying to cut down on this for right now. And we'll return to it at some point. But I need to focus more on my sports things and some of my other pursuits. So, all right, guys, that being said, I want to get into another biography this week. And, you know, I've done a lot of work recently on the Colombo crime family. You know, I've looked a lot into Bill Cotolo and Victor Arena, and we did a show on Carmine Persico. Today, I'm going to do a biography on an individual that I think really, in my estimation, is really one of the most violent, disturbing individuals in the history of the mafia. It's pretty simple. This is a guy that came from Brooklyn. This is a man that survived 2 assassination attempts. This is a man that to this day walks around with a pee bag attached to his leg because he'd been hurt in a shooting. This is a guy that allegedly ordered a hit on a New York City Police Department officer, and that was indeed followed through with, and that individual was killed. This is an individual that put in motion a hit on what he thought was a special assistant prosecutor for the U.S. Government. It ended up not being him, though. This is a guy that's been involved allegedly in a lot of crimes. And this is a man today that is right on the street. He's 81 years old. We're going to talk today about Joel Waverly Cacace, a guy that I think some people know of, but I think there's a lot of people that don't know much about him. So here we go. Joe Waverly Cacace on the sit down. Joe Waverly was born April 9th, 1941. And Joe Waverly was actually from Brooklyn. He actually grew up on a street called Waverly Avenue, hence his name, Joe Waverly. He was from Fort Greene. And if, weirdly enough, it's funny with Fort Greene because today, you know, Fort Greene doesn't necessarily exist anymore. If you look it up on a map, Fort Greene won't be there. Now, if you know anything about Fort Greene, it's basically just south of the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It's kind of in what we would call today like the upper yuppie area of Brooklyn. It's kind of right near the Barclays Center. It's between the Barclays and kind of downtown Dumbo area, right near the Navy Yard, as I said, near Williamsburg and basically to the west of Bed-Stuy. And today they actually call it like Clinton Hill, downtown Brooklyn. It's like a bunch of cobblestone streets and really nice, you know, homes and things of that nature. Joe Waverly was actually from that area, and that's how he got his nickname. His parents were actually from Puglia, which is in southern Italy, not far from Naples, just north of Calabria. Not a lot's known about Joe Waverly's like teenage or elementary school years, but there is rumor that his father was associated with the mafia. But I was unable to find any way to basically prove that. For a lot of years, though, Joe Waverly would get directly involved with the streets, and he would actually kind of evolve to moving towards more South Brooklyn, Sheepshead Bay, Bensonhurst, that area. And he'd actually get involved with all the typical mob rackets, gambling, loan sharking. He was hijacking cigarettes, you know, extortion, things of that nature. But what Joe Waverly realized pretty early is that if he had a legitimate income, a legitimate business, he could funnel a lot of his money through that. And if he were ever to get caught, he could just say, well, I'm a legit businessman. I have a business. He would own a floral shop at the intersection of Avenue U and East 14th Street down in Sheepshead Bay. And this is obviously much more of mob territory, right? This is, you know, Sheepshead Bay, you know, basically right near, you know, Benson and Marine Park and all these areas, right? You know, where, you know, this is where the Tommy Pateras came up, the Michael Scars De Leonardos, all the great mob guys, just really close to Gravesend, actually. So he would have that flower shop there, and he would actually spend most of his time there. In December of 1976, basically at 35, Joe Waverly was regularly involved with crime families, mostly with the Colombo crime family, doing a lot of stuff, earning. He was an associate. In December of 1976, Joe Waverly would leave his flower shop and walk towards his car. As he was getting into his car, he was ambushed by three individuals that were looking to rob him. They would actually shoot him at one point in the chest, and he'd be bleeding heavily. Joe Waverly would end up wrestling the gun away from one of the assailants and killing them. The other two individuals would run away from the scene. Joe Waverly would get into his car and drive himself to the closest police precinct not far away. It would end up being the 61st precinct on Avenue U. And he would actually drive down to the station with the assailant that he had killed still in the car with him. And he was able to survive. But it was something that he would have to mend himself back to health from. This was a pretty lethal gunshot. Now, it didn't end up killing him, but you know, he would kind of create his legend, if you will, because of that. You know, it's rare that someone is able to survive an attack like that. It's pretty brazen by these individuals. Now, no one was ever found as to have done that, but I would have to think maybe they had gotten wind that Joe Waverly would leave there with some cash and, you know, they thought, hey, let's try to rob this guy. Now, it's unclear as to when exactly Joe Waverly was made, but according to a confidential informant in the late 70s, he would say that Joe Waverly was made sometime around 1978 or 1979. And if you know anything about the Colombo family back then, one of their major making years was in 1978. And a lot of people would actually call into question a video that Michael Franzese put out several years ago on his YouTube channel, where he claims that he was made in 1975, but that it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that the Colombo crime family didn't end up making anyone until 1978. So it's likely that he just got the dates crossed. But it's likely that at that time he was made Joe Waverly in that sort of date range. Joe Waverly would actually slot right into a very legendary crew. And if you know anything about the individual I'm about to talk about, you understand. Joe Waverly would be placed into the crew of the Lethal Charles Charlie Moose Panarella. And for anyone that's not aware of Panarella, if you were to ask me who is the five most lethal people in the history of the mob, I would put Panarella in the top five. He doesn't get the kind of love that like Scarpa or DeMeo gets. But Panarella, in my estimation, I would probably put him and Michael Paradiso at the top of the two most dangerous individuals to me, as far as people that could just crack your fucking head or would cut your head off if they needed to. Panarella was a lethal individual, got to start very early. Really by 14, he had been arrested. I mean, he was a lethal individual. He had a wild crew, a lot of guys in that crew, Bill Cotolo, Joe Waverly, Jackie DeRoss. He had a lot of really, high-end individuals that would become high-end members of the mafia in his crew. The problem for Charlie Moose was in the mid-80s, he got into a beef with Carmine Persico. Basically, the crew of Panarella, some of the members of them, basically went and complained to Persico that he was abusive. He was taking a lot of money from them. He was kind of greedy in a way. At that point, I think Persico kind of realized, well, maybe this guy's a little bit of a concern. I don't want to kill him, so I'll just exile him and tell him to go out to Las Vegas. And that's exactly what Charlie Moose did. At that point, Joe Waverly would end up joining the crew of a guy called Joe Tomasello. Tomasello ran a crew out of Avenue U, the area that he had his floral shop in. And Joe Waverly would slot right into that crew in the mid-80s. Now, the good thing for Joe Waverly was he was able to really intertwine himself with Carmine Jr. Persico, which is a great person to know. You know, Joe Waverly kind of is known as he's the guy that survived a hit. He's a tough motherfucker. He can make money. And if I need him, he could take care of business for me. In 1987, as we know, Carmine Persico was in prison. We all know that by the time that, the 80s kicked around, Carmine spent a lot of time in prison. But in 1984, he would be indicted on multiple racketeering counts as part of the Colombo trial. He would then go to trial. And then ultimately, he would get jammed up in the commission case as well. On June 14th, 86, Persico gets 39 years, and then he gets the 100-year sentence. That runs consecutively in 87. So that's that. Carmine Persico is going away. He's never going to get out. He's labeled as dangerous by all sorts of people. And what does Carmine Persico want to do next? And this is the difference between Persico and like other level-headed individuals. People like Salerno and Corallo, they all said, all right, I'm done. I'm going away. That's that. I'm not going to like take umbrage with the prosecutor and try to kill him. Well, Carmine Persico did. And he would basically say, look, I'm going to kill not only Rudy Giuliani, but I'm going to kill this guy, William Aaronwald. Aaronwald was a Justice Department prosecutor. Now, the interesting thing about William Aaronwald is that he actually was not involved with Carmine Persico's case whatsoever. In fact, had never any dealings with the man. And it's unclear as to why Persico wanted to kill Aaronwald, but he decides from prison, this fucking guy's got to go. So he contacts Case, who's a loyal and trusted guy, and says, I need you to put this in motion. Here's the name. He frequents Queens, Long Island City. Get rid of him. Now, obviously, most people that would say, well, we're not hitting a fucking cop. We're not hitting a senator. We're not hitting a prosecutor. I was liking it back to The Wire. If you've ever seen The Wire, when Stringer Bell wants Slim Charles to kill Clay Davis, and Avon comes out and basically says, you kill somebody like that, the whole fucking world's going to stand up and take notice. And that's exactly what Persico did. He became just, not that he was ever level-headed, but he became just nuts. I mean, he wanted to kill everybody. That's just kind of who Persico was. But the hit is put in motion. So Kikay's contacts two brothers that he knew called Enrico and Vinnie Carini. And these two guys were mob associates. They were killers, and they were farmed out with work and did what they had to do. They also had a friend a guy called Frank Smith. And these three guys, the brothers and Frank Smith, would handle hits. Now, Frank Smith ultimately was a Colombo and a Lucchese associate. And he'll be an important name to remember in this. They were tasked with it. They were given a note that basically says irritable. Now, this hit would actually go down on March 20th, 1987, inside a laundromat called Young's in Long Island City. Mr. Aaronwald is spotted and he is killed inside the laundromat, shot multiple times. So that's that. The mob had killed a special U.S. prosecutor, the first of its kind to ever really happen. The problem was it was the wrong William Aaronwald. In fact, it wasn't William Aaronwald. It was actually his father, George Aaronwald. George Aaronwald, who obviously resembled his own son, was basically stalked and a blunder would ensue. And that was that. Now, obviously, Case is absolutely furious. Persico kind of divulged this information through underling. So I don't know if he's too worried, but Case is obviously very upset because he tasked these three idiots with killing the guy and they killed the wrong person. Now, remember, this is the important thing to remember about all this. When Carini and his brother were given this job, they were basically just given a piece of paper that said Aaronwald on it. So I guess they looked it up. They probably looked similar. They just thought it was the same guy. And that was that. Now, Case realized that if he was going to not spend the rest of his life in prison, he was going to have to take out some people to further himself from this killing. So in June of 1987, he doesn't wait long. Enrico and Vinnie Carini were killed. They were found dead in their cars in Brooklyn. Now, also what Case does is he says, okay, I believe obviously here Frank Smith was just kind of involved. He wasn't the guy that ultimately killed him. So maybe I can reason with this guy. So he goes and says to Frank Smith, look, if do you understand what happened here? You're not going to take any revenge on me for killing your friends. Are you with me? Blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to have any problems here. And again, Frank Smith had connections to the Lucchese crime family. So he was able to kind of smooth some things over. Nope, I'm with you. Blah, 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 blah. Now, Frank Smith down the road would actually cooperate. He said that he was blown away that he wasn't killed that day by Joe Waverly, because it could have been very easy to kill Joe Waverly, for him to kill him. But he didn't ultimately do it. But Frank Smith would be a problem down the road. Now, obviously, we say rest in peace to George Aaronwald. He's just another one of the innocent people killed by a murderous psychopath. William Aaronwald would actually survive, and he would actually last longer than Carmine Persico. He would actually die on October 29th, 2020. As we said, may he and both his father rest in peace. Now, for Joe Waverly, he wouldn't stop completely with the Eddie Carini stuff. It was actually alleged that after Enrico Carini was killed, Joe Waverly actually started shacking up with a woman called Kim Kenna, a buxom blonde, who actually had been the former wife of Eddie Carini. By this point, Joe Waverly had moved to an area of Long Island called Deer Park, Long Island. And the thing about Deer Park is it is one of those kind of trendy suburbs, right? A place that everybody wants to live. It's pretty far out. I'll pass Farmingdale. I'm not too far away from Patchogue, but it's still somewhat close to the city. And he's able to kind of rest his feet up and hang out. Now, during the 1990s, as we know, the Colombo War would start again, yet another Colombo War. And weirdly enough, Joe Waverly would actually shift his agreements. He would actually side with Victor Arena during the war, and he would kind of do what the Colombos did, shoot each other. At one point in 1991, one of the high-value targets on the side of Persico was Greg DeGrimby Brascarpa. Waverly would actually stalk him to an area of Brooklyn where he would come up on his car and shoot him multiple times. The problem was his gun misfired and he wasn't able to kill Greg Scarpa. Now, as we know with the mob, you shoot at somebody, they're going to come back at you. In February of 1992, Joe Waverly was seen in the area of Brooklyn at a dry cleaner shop. As he walked out of the dry cleaner, multiple individuals ran up to him and basically tried to shoot him multiple times, including Greg Scarpa, who at one point it was alleged that the MAC-10 he was firing would actually misfire and jam. It was alleged that Joe Waverly was shot at 14 different times and multiple bullets would hit him. In fact, one would actually hit him in the testicles and he would actually lose a testicle. And as I said, to this day, still has to walk with some sort of assistance to help him go to the bathroom. Now, for Joe Waverly, he would have many beefs with Greg Scarpa. Greg Scarpa was a high value target. Bill Cotola wanted him dead. The arena side wanted Greg Scarpa dead. Now, some of it has to do with there is belief that at one point Joe Waverly put on the street that Greg Scarpa was a rat. Now, Greg Scarpa obviously was a rat, and Cacace had very good rat detection. If only the family would have listened to him. Now, once the Colombo War kind of fades, and we talked about this a little bit during the Mush Russo show, once the Reno Persico War ends, Vicarina goes to jail, Persico's locked up. Little alley boy Persico, Carmine's son, would take over for a little bit. He would then go to jail, and Carmine's cousin, Mush Russo, would take over. And he would really take the family through some calm waters. And this is where Joe Waverly starts to become pretty integral to the family. And after little alley boy, Mush Russo takes over, you have guys like Tommy Gialli, Joe Waverly, Bill Cotolo for a period of time up until the early 2000s. This is where some calming waters come over the Colombo crime family. The problem is, as we know, that doesn't last forever. Now, for Waverly, he would ultimately become consigliere in the mid-90s. There was a point where he would flirt with being underboss. He was at one point street boss for the family. But weirdly enough, Joe Waverly was never a capo regime. He actually went from soldier right to the upper echelons, which isn't normal usually. Generally, you get your own crew or whatever, but Joe Waverly did it in a little bit different way, which is interesting. As I said earlier, Joe Waverly would ultimately go past dating Kim Kenna and actually marry her. They would be married in the mid-90s, but by 1996, Kim Kenna and Joe Waverly decided that marriage was not for them, and Kenna would file for divorce. By 1997, Kim Kenna, who, weirdly enough, guys, Waverly was actually her third husband. All three of her husbands had been mob connected. Two had died, and one was Joe Waverly. So three in all, maybe it's time to start looking elsewhere. Maybe you want to date a businessman or a police officer or a mechanic or something. And that's exactly what she did. Kim Kenna realized that she was getting older. She probably has to mature a little bit. Obviously, you've had many failed marriages. I need to wise up. So she starts dating a man called Ralph Doles. Doles was a housing authority police officer for the New York Police Department. And from all encompassed looks, he was a pretty great individual. He's said to be a great cop. He was always very much someone that enjoyed, you know, kind of trying to help kids in the neighborhood and really just kind of be a great cop. And at one point, Kim Kenna would say about her husband, it's not easy being me. My life will never be quality anymore. And this has to do with the fact that, like her other husbands, she would ultimately lose her man, Ralph Doles. It was alleged that at one point, Cacace became enraged that his ex-wife didn't want to be with him and that she wanted to be with a cop. And it didn't help that Ralph Doles was not Italian. He was what Cacace called, quote, a Mexican, which you'd have to think was a little racial in a way. Joe Waverly probably didn't like the fact that his ex-wife, who he still loved and wanted to be with, was with her, and B, how does he feel like he's competent enough to be with her? So Joe Waverly does the unthinkable. He decides, I'm going to have Doles killed. That's the way to get Kenna back. Now, it didn't matter that Doles was a cop. Joe Waverly had a pedigree of everyone else. He was higher up than pretty much everyone else, so he could dictate who gets killed and who doesn't. So Joe Waverly goes to a guy called Tommy Shots Gioeli. Gioeli was a high-ranking member and had a mean hit crew underneath him. A kid called Dino Calabro, little Dino Saraceno, Joey Caves Compitello, Tommy McLaughlin, all sorts of guys, guys that were willing to kill for Tommy Shots. They had a crew out in Long Island and did a lot of scores and killed a lot of people. So Case goes to Gioeli and says, this fucking Mexican kid at the social club needs to go. It was Ralph Doles. Now, he lied to Gioeli and said that he was just some kid that fucked around at the social club and needs to go. Obviously, if Tommy Shots knew that the guy was a cop, he probably would have found a way to not do it. Tommy Shots goes to his protege, Dino Calabro, who had killed many people by that point, and says, I need you to hit this guy. This is his address. This is what he looks like. He's just some social club asshole. He's got to go. So on the evening of August 25th, 1997, Ralph Doles finishes up a shift at about 11 o'clock in Brooklyn. He drives home to his house. Now, at that point, Dino Calabro and little Dino Saraceno, who were cousins, would basically say that they had waited at the home for a while. They had been looking to kill this guy for a while. They finally got him. On August 25th, 1997, they're hanging outside of their car. Doles comes walking up, basically says, what's up? And they begin to shoot him multiple times. And, you know, Dino Calabro, who, as I'll say, ended up cooperating, he would talk about the night on the stand when they killed Ralph Doles. Dino Calabro said he and little Dino followed Doles home and the cop was killed moments after they got out of his cutlass. He would say, Doles pulled to the right where he lives. I pulled off to the left. Me and little Dino jumped out. Doles didn't know the two approaching men were about to whack him. He said, what's up? Calabro testified. Calabro would respond with, we shot him, quote, multiple times. Doles reportedly staggered backward and fell into the hood of his car. Calabro said, when we shot him, he fell back. I shot him with my cousin Dino. Now they would leave the scene, go home, clean up, go to sleep. They wake up the next day and find out that they killed a cop. Big news. It's on the front page of the paper. Everything. And they would also say that Dino said that he'd used a .44 caliber Magnum revolver. Little Dino would use a .45 semi-automatic. They would use baseball caps, walkie-talkies. They had police scanners. Now, Calabro would say that the next day when you find out that Doles is a cop, he got the kill order obviously from Tommy Shots, but that the request came from Joe Waverly. He basically said, we don't kill police officers. And then when he found out, he was livid about it. And he at that point would ask Tommy Shots, quote, should we take out Joe Waverly for this? He would say, I asked Tommy, he screwed us. Let's kill him. Tommy Shots would take a step back and listen and said, let me see. So they wanted to kill Joe Waverly for this fuck up. But he basically lied, and now they're on the hook for a cop kill. Now, for Joe Waverly, he would just continue business as usual. And for the most part, no one ever believed that they would find the killer of Ralph Doles, especially Kim Kenna, his wife. Now, from 2001 to 2003, Joe Waverly would get right back to what he does best, being a mobster. He was at this point a very high up in the Colombo crime family. At one point, he would become the street boss, as I said. But Joe Waverly, it continued to be what he did best, be a mobster. Now, during 2001 and 2003, the federal government would allege that Joe Waverly would run five Brooklyn-based gambling sites that brought in big money, including an underground casino at a swanky Bergen Beach yacht club called the Bergen Yacht Club. So he was involved in some big money-making opportunities. And the feds would find this out through wiretaps, basically, that they placed on not only Joe Waverly's phones, but members of his inner circle. Now, Joe Waverly would basically say on the phone in a conversation with an associate called Jerry Esposito that he ran a game at 2657 East 66th Street in Mill Basin, which was the Bergen Yacht Club. He would say, quote, "It's a casino. There's roulette, blackjack, craps, everything. Three nights a week, full bar, full buffet, full everything, all high class, waitresses with bow ties." Sounds pretty nice, actually. Now, Case would also say, according to Gangland News, that he had two other card games belonging to another Capo regime called Benjamin Castellazzo. Then when he went to prison, he took them over. One of the card games was run at a 6608 18th Avenue in Bensonhurst by one of his associates, Robert Bobby Bibbs Casamassino, who was close with Joe Waverly. They would also talk about on the phone some of the crimes that they would also commit outside of illegal gambling and other things. He would say that Joe Cacace would order people to do what they had to do to not only collect, but not have to pay people as well. On May 20, 2001, an individual named Carmine Badanza, who was a member of Cacace's inner circle, would give a gambler a beating after the house did not have sufficient funds to pay off the customer's winnings. So in a roundabout way, this gambler goes in, wins some money, and Badanza, this guy, decides to, hey, instead of paying him, I'm just going to give him a fucking beating. And in a conversation, Joe Waverly would tell a crew member called Patrick Picciarello, quote, "Carmine hit a guy out there last night. I think the guy won. They didn't have the money to pay him. They took him outside. I know he cracked him a couple times. The guy ran. They chased him, and I closed up shop." So Joe Waverly was not only killing people, ordering kills, but he was also very much involved with gambling, very much involved with extortion, very much involved with loan sharking. And he was administering that members of his crew just instead of paying people, just beat them up. Now, this goes back to the show we did on Griselda Blanco. And it kind of sounds like he pulled a Griselda Blanco where Griselda just didn't want to pay people. So she just killed them. Now, Joe Waverly didn't have them killed, but people in his organization were also doing things. Now, this is also a very interesting story because according to the same court papers that all this stuff was filed in subsequently that we'll talk about, 7 years earlier in the mid to late 90s, it was alleged that Joe Waverly actually represented an MC, a motorcycle gang, that had threatened the owners of the Vault, which was a sex club. I guess the club failed to repay a debt that they owed the motorcycle crew, and Joe Waverly spoke on behalf of the bikers with the DeCavalcanti crime family at a sit-down. I guess from what I understand, the sit-down would take place at a different spot. But, you know, the goal was to create some sort of payment schedule that the loan could be repaid. So it's kind of interesting. Joe Waverly was handling all sorts of things, and he had a lot of power. In January of 2003, though, the government would catch up with Joe Waverly's case. In that year, he would be indicted on not only gambling, extortion, loan sharking, and assault charges, but also on several murders. Also along in that indictment were members of his crew, including Carmine Baldanza, Bobby Bibbs Casamassano, Jerry Esposito, Luca Di Matteo, and other Colombo crime family members. The problem for Joe Waverly was he was going to have to face the truth that he likely was going to have to face some sort of murder beef. And that's what the government tried to bring. They would ultimately get him to plead guilty on having a hand in basically passing a message that someone needed to be killed. And this had to do with the hit back on George Ehrenwald, you know, getting rid of some of the evidence there and by having people killed. He would admit to the government that he did have a hand in someone dying, but that he took responsibility. And what the government basically said was, all right, it's 2003. You're, you know, basically how old, right? You're born in 1941. You're, you know, 60s. We're going to give you 20 years. You know, you get out late 70s. We're going to try to still get you on a murder. We could still bring you on something else, but we're going to give you 20 years. And Joe Waverly would accept it. He would plead guilty. And Joe Waverly in 2004 would get 20 years in federal prison. So you figure he's going to do probably 16-ish, gets out in 2020. That was kind of the goal. Now, I think for the feds, they would say, look, we have all sorts of ammunition on this guy. Maybe we can get someone to flip. He's going to be behind the wall. Let's keep working back on some of these murders. Maybe we could put this fuck away for life. That was the goal. Because Joe Waverly deserves to die in prison. It's pretty simple. In December of 2008, Joe Waverly is charged with ordering the murder on Ralph Doles, the police officer. And what we would find out is that Dino Calabro would be the main conduit in the government's bid to convict Joe Waverly. They basically were trying to prove beyond the shadow of doubt that not only did the mob kill Ralph Doles, but Joe Waverly was the one that ordered the hit. The problem for the government and for Dino Calabro is that no one really believed him. And ultimately for Mr. Waverly, he would be acquitted of this and beat the rap on November 26, 2013. So the feds are probably going to have to admit that eventually Joe Waverly Cacase was going to get out of jail. They wanted to put him away forever. Didn't work, though. No one believed these guys. Now, the individuals involved in this hit, most notably Dino Calabro. Dino Calabro is a free man. That's unclear what he does now. He is in the witness protection program, as far as I know. Little Dino Saraceno got 50 years. Now, whether he ever gets out, we don't know. He does have a release date, but who knows if he'll survive that long. As far as Joe Waverly, he would move around. He spent some time in some really heavy USPs and things of that nature, but he would ultimately be released from the Federal Correctional Institution at Ashland, Kentucky in May of 2020. Now, I do want to get into a fairly odd situation that would happen to Joe Waverly Cacase. He would actually get some bad news of his own, and he would find out that in 2015, his son, Joel Jr., a.k.a. JoJo Cacase, would actually die of a sudden heart attack. And this was sad news for Joe Waverly. It was a son that, you know, weirdly enough, didn't really follow him into the life. At one point, it was alleged that Joel Waverly Jr. ended up having a job in the union. And at one point had a no-show job, but he didn't necessarily follow his father into the life. But he was able to build up a pretty decent life for himself. He had a pretty nice home out in Long Island. He had had a daughter, a girl called Dina Marie. And I bring this up because a weird situation would actually develop after JoJo Jr. passed. According to members of the family, I guess from what I've gathered in all this, there was some sort of will allegedly set up by JoJo Cacase. And then after he died, the daughter would find out that basically it was a fake will that his mother, who was Joe Waverly's wife, basically created and forged in hopes that she would get a lot of the money that her son allegedly had and basically will put the daughter on the street. Now, I guess the mother, Vita Rose Cacase, who was 70-ish years old, was given sole control of her son's assets until 2028, when she will be 87, and Medina Marie will be 31. According to the stake, the holdings of the estate are worth more than $1 million. And Dina Marie Cacase, who was Joe Waverly's granddaughter, she would basically say that she's being screwed out of this and that the entire family is out to get her and that they don't want her to actually get any of the money, which is probably fucked up because in the end, her father, JoJo Jr., probably just wants his daughter to be taken care of in the case that he died. That's why he created the will. It's just kind of a weird story, but as far as an outcome on this, I've really been unable to find what actually happened here. From what I understand, this happened in 2017, 2018-ish. Dina Marie is obviously still several years away from being the age she needs to be to get all this, but I guess we'll kind of figure that out when we get to it. As far as Joe Waverly, he is still alive. He is 81 years old. The question is, what does Joe Waverly do now? You know, we talk all the time about what does the mob look like today? Look, as we know, the Colombo crime family is in a very precarious state. Most of the upper echelon of this family, including the underboss, the consigliere, high-end capos, including Teddy Persico, are all in jail. One of the other capos, Joe Amato, he's in jail. You know, there's a lot of people in jail. The boss of the family just died, Mush Russo. Little Alley Boy's never coming home. It's possible. Now, again, this is just an opinion. It's not what's true. It's just my opinion. It is possible that if Joe Waverly is in the streets, you know, maybe at some point he's given the boss title. He's had it before. He's obviously old, but he's still spry from what I understand. Is he involved? I have no idea. I don't know if Joe's involved. I'm not in the mafia, as I've said, so I don't know. But it's possible for sure, because I think in the end, the truth is about Joe Waverly, he's a gangster. But the truth also is that Joe Waverly should be in prison and he should die in prison. He's a dangerous lunatic who not only was involved with killing the father of a federal prosecutor, but he also, as we would believe, ordered the death of a New York City Police Department officer. Now, Joe Waverly would say, well, that's not true. I was acquitted of that case. And look, I guess he's right in the end, but in the end, he's been very questioned on a lot of this stuff. You know, when we go back to the wife of Joe Waverly, his one-time wife, you know, Kim Kenna. You know, did she do a great job in picking women or picking men? No, she hasn't. You know, but it's weird because we also ask ourselves, what about her? You know, when Joe Waverly was acquitted of killing her husband, you know, she could have helped. Federal prosecutors wanted Kim Kenna to testify, but Kenna would say that she lawyered up and would have invoked the Fifth Amendment not to answer questions. So you have to ask yourself, if she loved Ralph Doles the way she did, why didn't she assist them in helping have the killer brought to justice? Now, a lot of people would speculate that Kim Kenna knows more about what happened than she mentioned to the FBI or to the NYPD. One source from the police department would say, quote, she's a drama queen. She only cares about herself. Kim Kenna would also say, quote, I'm not going to take the stand and perjure myself. What the hell do they want from me? I couldn't add anything to their case that they didn't already know about. She would tell that to the New York Daily News. She would also say, quote, if the feds had treated me like I was a victim, which I was, she might have thought differently about testifying. She would also blast U.S. prosecutors for trying to show the jury notes from an interview with an NYPD investigator the day after Ralph Doles was killed on August 26, 1997, in which she denied being previously married to Kid Case. Kenna said Doles' parents were present during the interview, and she was only trying to shield them from more grief. She would also say, quote, who doesn't know that I was married to Joe? So it's just kind of a sad situation, but I guess if you ask me, something tells me that Kim Kenna knows something here. Now, who knows? She would also say about when she told him she was leaving him, she said, I told him I was leaving him, and he said, fine. I asked for nothing. I wanted nothing. Who would think anything was going to happen? So, you know, kind of a sad situation in general, whether we believe or don't believe Kim Kenna. I don't know what Kim Kenna is up to now. She may be on her eighth husband by this point. She doesn't have very good luck with men, I guess. You have to also almost feel bad for her because she doesn't seem like she's completely all there. But who knows? As I said, we don't really know what Joe Waverly's status is. However, you know, he's definitely a dangerous, you know, person, and society would be more safe if he wasn't around. What he does now, I don't know. Maybe he's just trying to enjoy the rest of his life in relative anonymity with his grandkids and his family. I don't know. But I guess as we know, once a gangster, always a gangster. As always, guys, thanks for joining me here on another week of the Sit Down. I hope everyone took what I said earlier and just kind of understand where I'm coming from. I just need a break from all this. I basically did a year and half basically of this show, and you know, it's time for me to focus on some other things that are just super important that I have to attend to. So if I do come back at some point, we'll definitely get back into mob stuff. We'll do a lot more kind of ever-arcing stuff on true crime. You'll get into some other things as well. But in the meantime, join us next week. We have a really cool episode coming out. I got some special guests that are going to join us next week. And we'll do one final show for the time being on the sit down here. And then I would urge you, if you want to show some love, come check out what I'm doing in sports. I've got a lot of cool announcements coming up. Hopefully some more shows. I know a lot of you like that stuff. But as I always say, go check us out on YouTube as well. I'm still going to do some content on YouTube, just some kind of quick 10, 15, 20 minute videos once a week or so. We'll keep the mob stuff fresh and current. So I'm just trying to cut down some of the work that I'm doing right now. So we'll return at some point. But do me a favor, join me next week for a final episode as we go on a little hiatus. But as always, I'm Jeff Nadeau. If you have any questions, you have any concerns, you want to send your regards, whatever, do me a favor. You can send them to me. Just check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. You can also email the show if you really want to at the Sit Down 777 at gmail.com. The Sit Down 777 at gmail.com. All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the episode this week. We'll see you next week here on the Sit Down.